Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for being here. My name is Karen Merriam, and I'm the chapter chair of the Santa Lucia chapter of Sierra Club. And I'm just one of the many people who have worked very hard for about 9 months now to bring this event to San Luis Obispo. Let me give you an example. The reason we're kind of starting off slowly here is because AGP Video has very kindly agreed to film our entire event, and it'll be everything that happens in this room as well as the panels that'll be happening in the other room. It's a huge logistical chore that they have been working on for many hours this morning already, and we want to be sure we get it right. So we're starting a little late this morning, and we ask that you help with the kind of delay in the schedule. By when Dr. Goodstein is through his presentation, we'll be breaking up into two different rooms to see the panelists. Choose your panel, and then you will look for, in your program, you will see wonderful little designs next to each panel. There's either a blue design or an orange design, the wind or the sun. Find your panel and then look over the door in the lounge or here, and it will tell you where you should be for your panel. Andrew Christie, are you here? He's around. If somebody wants to peek outside this door, you could. This one's gold. So this one's the sun. So if you have a panel that is marked by the sun, you stay in here. If you have a panel that's marked by the wind with the blue, then it'll be in the lounge directly across the hall. And, of course, you've already seen that we have a full room of exhibits on the left and also refreshments, coffee, tea, things to snack on. There will be fruit, watermelon, all kinds of great stuff. By the time you go and look for water, we'll have some water there. I want to just to go back for a minute and tell you who, because I think this is important to our event, who has been organizing this. I'm just going to read down the list. It's on the back of your program, but I just want you to understand what a broad community of people it is who have put this together. Coast National Bank, Cal Poly School of Architecture, especially the Renewable Energy Institute, Cienega Energy Systems, San Luis Obispo County Air Pollution Control District. Larry Allen will be introducing Dr. Goodstein in a moment. PG&E, they have a wonderful exhibit right outside the front door. Santa Lucia Chapter of Sierra Club. The Chamber of Commerce, San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. Home Builders Association. Jerry Bunin's here somewhere. There he is in the back. EcoSlow. Computer Network Services, County Supervisor Jim Patterson, and all the other supervisors have contributed to this. Sierra Club California Energy and Climate Change Committee, and Slow Green Build. And we've had input from many, many other organizations. Major contributing sponsors for today are PG&E, the County Supervisors, San Luis Obispo Council of Governments, Air Pollution Control District, and also the Central Coast Clean Cities Coalition is having a display of alternative fuel vehicle cars out back. Madonna Inn has been very generous to provide housing for our out-of-town guests. Signcraft made our wonderful banner over the front door. If you didn't notice it, take a look. Novo Restaurant, the City of Arroyo Grande, Hope Dance, our wonderful community news magazine, New Times, and downstairs working all morning since 5 o'clock are Noah Smuckler and Laura Lopez, and they are called Organic Chefs to Go. They're preparing your lunch as we speak. So lunches will be available at noon, box lunches. They're gourmet. Try to remember whether you ordered vegetarian or meat, and you'll pick the boxes accordingly. And you'll love it, whichever one you pick up. They're just terrific. So I'm Nancy and Steve, are you ready for Dr. Goodstein's talk to begin? Yeah. Okay, so with no further ado, I want to turn this over to Larry Allen. Oh, there are restrooms in the far corner. Very important to know. Restrooms over there. Please feel free to come and go during the day as you need to and see the exhibits. Once we break from Dr. Goodstein's talk, I would urge you to go directly to your panel, whether it's in this room or the other one. So we're going to have to pick up time during the day. So if you can help us do that by going to the panels, and the panels will try and start as quickly as they can. We have a full and wonderful day, so thank you for being here.
Thank you, Karen. Karen was quite modest. It didn't really say anything about herself, but she has been the chief organizer of this event. I would think everyone owes her a debt of gratitude. And I'd like to thank you all for joining us here today and taking time out of your busy schedules to participate in the forums that we're going to have today on one of the most important issues facing us, and that is energy. And whether you're concerned about the environment or your pocketbook or your current lifestyle needs, today you're going to be provided with many current-day solutions that will better ensure a sustainable future. And our panel discussions will provide insights on the building sector, both for your home, your businesses, communities, also for transportation needs and vehicle technologies. We're very excited about the speakers that have come together to discuss solutions to our energy challenges. We're very excited about the way this whole forum has come together because it's a result of a very interesting group of local organizations, companies that you would not normally see working together on the same project, on the same cause. The fact that we have industry, financial institutes, the building industry, government agencies, and local environmental community speaks to the importance of this topic and how essential it is for us to begin addressing a way to get off the fossil fuel diet. And we're very fortunate today to have Dr. David Goodstein kick off our symposium. Since 1988, he's been the Vice Provost and Professor of Physics at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. He's the director and host of The Mechanical Universe, which is an educational television series on physics that's been used by millions of students around the world. He recently turned his attention to fossil fuels and the climate of planet Earth. His book, Out of Gas, The End of the Age of Oil, was named by the New York Times as one of the most notable books of the year. Dr. Goodstein has spent many years better understanding the impacts the industry has had on our planet, drawing conclusions that illustrate the need to kick the fossil fuel habit. He's truly a prophet for our times. Please join me in welcoming Dr. David Goodstein.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Up on the side screen there is a picture of a book that I wrote a couple of years ago, and by an astounding coincidence, it has exactly the same title as today's talk. Let's start out with some myths about energy. The first one is that $3 a gallon is too much to pay for gasoline. At $3 a gallon, that's about 75 cents a liter. You pay twice that much for a bottle of drinking water. The fact is that gasoline at $3 a gallon is just about the cheapest liquid you can buy in the United States, and that's a big part of the problem. Oil companies produce oil. At least they say they produce oil. They talk about production, rate of production, and so on. In fact, no oil company ever produced a drop of oil. Oil is produced by the sun and the earth over hundreds of millions of years. The oil companies simply extract it and sell it, and that's why it's so cheap. We must conserve energy. The conservation of energy is one of the deepest laws of physics. Energy is always conserved no matter what we do. So we don't need to conserve energy. There is something we need to conserve, however. It's called fuel. When we run out of oil, the marketplace will take care of it. That's what the economists say. I will look very carefully at that argument in the course of today's lecture. There's enough fossil fuel in the ground to last for hundreds of years. Once again, I will look very carefully at that in the course of today's lecture. Nuclear energy is dangerous. At least many people think it's dangerous. Most technically trained people understand that nuclear energy is the cleanest, the safest source of energy we have, but it will not solve our problems. The greenhouse effect and global warming are bad. I will argue that without the greenhouse effect and global warming, we would not be here. So we'll start out with the thermal behavior of the Sun-Earth system. The Sun shines white because of nuclear reactions internally and sends white light out in all directions. 93 million miles away, the tiny globe of the Earth intercepts an infinitesimal fraction of that. 30% of the light that lands on the Earth is reflected, and 70% is absorbed by the Earth. The reflected light can be seen from the Moon, for example, in this picture of Earth rising on the Moon, and seen in the colors of the continents and the polar caps and the oceans. It's a simple calculation to figure out what temperature the Earth would need to radiate back into space the same amount of energy it absorbs from space. It has to do that in order to stay in balance. And the result of that calculation is 255 kelvins, or minus 18 degrees Celsius, or 0 degrees Fahrenheit. I think that if the temperature of the Earth were, mean temperature of the Earth were really 0 degrees Fahrenheit, we would not be here. We would not have evolved. The greenhouse effect is the most important part of our climate. Before the Industrial Revolution, we had an 88% greenhouse effect. The atmosphere of the Earth is transparent to the red, white-hot energy from the Sun, but it's virtually opaque to the infrared radiation with which the Earth tries to radiate its energy back out into space. 88% of the energy is intercepted and then radiated back out into space and radiated back down to the Earth, warming the Earth to a temperature of 287 kelvins, or 14 degrees Celsius, or 57 degrees Fahrenheit. And at that balmy temperature, we evolved, climbed down from the trees, and started building steam engines. There are important feedback effects. For example, if the Earth is a little bit warmer because of carbon dioxide that we pour into the atmosphere, the polar caps melt. That makes the Earth less shiny, so that makes the Earth warmer, and it amplifies the effect. On the other hand, there are people who believe that the freshening of the northern waters, the northern waters will become less salty, could reverse the great thermohaline flow that governs the waters of the oceans and lead to global cooling instead of global warming. These effects are very complicated. For a mere physicist like me, they're too much, and so we like to look at limiting cases. One limiting case is if the Earth had no greenhouse gases at all, the temperature of the Earth would immediately fall to 255 kelvins, or 0 degrees Fahrenheit, but that would not be the end of it, because at that temperature, all the waters on the Earth would freeze, the Earth would become much shinier, and become much colder still. The other limiting case is if we increased the 88% greenhouse effect to 100%. There's no telling what would happen then, but we have a very good model. The planet Venus is very much like Earth. It's a little closer to the Sun, so it ought to be a little bit warmer than the Earth. That's a very weak effect. So Venus could be very Earth-like in temperature, but it isn't. The Russians dropped a probe to the surface, and we know that the surface temperature is hotter than molten lead. And that's because of a runaway poisonous greenhouse effect. So the Earth could be a frozen wasteland, or it could be a Venusian inferno with the same solar flux that we have now. It is neither, fortunately for us. These are traces from the Vostok ice core. The upper trace shows the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere in parts per million. The lower curve shows the methane concentration in the atmosphere in parts per billion. And the middle curve shows the temperature. And you can see that the temperature over the past 400,000 years has tracked the greenhouse gases quite accurately. In the last 10,000 years, Thank you. in the last 10,000 years. See if I can get this. The temperature has stabilized near the high end, and it's during that period that civilization arose. What this graph cannot show is what's happened in the past 200 years. In the past 200 years, the concentration of carbon dioxide has increased from 280 parts per million to 380 parts per million, and the concentration of methane in the atmosphere has doubled. If the temperature were to follow that trend as it's followed all the previous trends, the results would be disastrous indeed. We are doing an uncontrolled experiment with the climate of the only planet we have. It is a very foolish thing to be doing. In the 19th century, the steam engine was invented. James Watt, a young mechanic fooling around trying to repair a steam engine, thought of a better way of making steam engines in 1765, and his better way of making steam engines kicked off the Industrial Revolution. By the turn of the century, by the turn of the 19th century, railroads were being built. Railroads had two effects. One of them is that they needed coal for fuel, but the other is that they provided stable roadbeds to deliver coal many miles from where it was mined. The growth of urban areas created a great demand for illumination. Whale oil became popular for that for a while, but by the middle of the century, the whales were pretty well fished out. And Edwin Drake, in 1859, drilled the world's first oil well in northwestern Pennsylvania. At first, the oil was used for illumination and lubrication, but in 1861, Nicholas Otto, a German entrepreneur, invented the world's first gasoline-burning engine, and soon oil was in demand, great demand as fuel. The result over the past 150 years is that we can no longer live on light as it comes from the sun, as we did before the beginning of the 19th century. We are thoroughly dependent on oil, and we have created a trap for ourselves because the oil will eventually run out. There's only a finite supply, and until, the question is when. This plot shows on the left, on the right-hand side, the pie chart shows where the reserves are, two-thirds in the Middle East, 10 times as much as in South and Central America, 10 times as much as in Africa, 10 times as much as in the former Soviet Union, and so on. It's the only important player in the game. The Middle East is all that counts. The right-hand bar chart shows how much oil is in reserve. The last bar chart shows 1,000 million barrels or a trillion barrels. So a trillion barrels are in the ground where we know where it is, ready to be pumped out, and that should be very comforting, but that's the wrong way to think about it. In 1956, Hubbert was a geologist and predicted that around 1970, the U.S. dominance of the oil market would end. He was virtually laughed out of his profession for making such a ridiculous pronouncement, but when 1970 came around, he turned out to be exactly right, as these data show. The black dots are the data, and the pink curve is the kind of curve that Hubbert used to predict the data. So this plot shows the reserves and discovery of oil in at present. I can't get the pointer to work. The left-hand plot shows the reserves since 1980. And you can see that a big discontinuity occurred in OPEC's reserves in the middle 1980s. But on the right-hand graph, you can see that there were no important discoveries in OPEC countries in the middle 1980s. What happened instead was that OPEC changed its quota rules for how much oil each country could pump, and the oil appeared like magic out of nowhere. That is not geological oil, that is political oil. The right-hand graph shows the history of discoveries, and you can see that worldwide oil discovery peaked around 1960 and has been declining ever since. The other graph, the other curve on the graph shows production or extraction of oil, and you can see that it crossed over the discovery curve around 1980, 25 years ago, and has been higher ever since. We've been producing, using oil faster than we've been discovering it for the past 25 years. Of course, that means that the reserve numbers should go down, but instead they constantly go up even before and after the big discontinuity. In any case, the kind of data on the right is the kind of data that Hubbard had from the lower 48 in 1956, so we ought to be able to predict worldwide the worldwide Hubbard's peak, the peak in worldwide oil production based on these data. I don't know why this is not changing. Can somebody help me with this? The upper curve shows worldwide oil use, and the extrapolation of the curve is the prediction of a model that was published in Scientific American in 1998, and it shows a peak just about now. Nobody knows what will happen when that peak occurs, but we did a couple of dry runs in 1972 and again in 1979 when the Arabs embargoed oil, knowing that the American oil was running short, and again in 1979 with the Iranian Revolution. And in both cases, we had mile-long lines at gas stations in despair for the future of our way of life. This peak that's predicted to occur just about now will not be temporary and will not be short-lived. It will be forever. You have to use a certain amount of caution in interpreting data like that. First of all, they use 1.8 trillion barrels as the total amount that nature ever made for us. Looking at the data today, I would say that 2 trillion barrels is a more accurate number, and that would put off the peak a little bit. The new technology is the equivalent of new discovery, and so that helps put off the peak. The increasing price of oil, and as we know, we all know, oil went up in recent times and it's gone down again. The increasing price of oil makes more available because more technology can be applied. And the reserve numbers, the numbers for how much is in reserve, are very soft, as we've already seen. Nevertheless, the basic idea is right. That is, the supply of oil will rise from zero, reach a maximum that will never be exceeded, and fall back to zero again. And we will be in trouble not when we pump the last drop of oil, but when we reach the maximum, because then increasing demand will meet decreasing supply with disastrous results. Kenneth DeFays, who is an oil man, knew that Hubbard had been right and that the peak in the United States had been reached when he read the following line in the San Francisco Chronicle in the spring of 1971. The Texas Railroad Commission announced 100% allowable for next month. Now, we're not all oil people, so we don't know what that means, but I'll give you an interpretation of it. The Texas Railroad Commission was the quaintly named cartel that governed the supply of oil in the United States. When it announced 100% allowable, it governed it by manipulating the excess capacity of Texas. When it announced 100% allowable for next month, it was announcing that it no longer had control of the market. It had lost control of the market, and Texas was free to pump flat out. OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, was quickly organized after that to do for the world what the Texas Railroad Commission had done for Texas, and it has been manipulating world oil supplies ever since, assuming the excess capacity of Saudi Arabia. So I've always thought that the announcement that the worldwide peak had been reached would be the announcement that Saudi Arabia was pumping flat out. And that announcement was made in the New York Times on February 24, 2004. Front page story, forecast of rising oil demand challenges tired Saudi fields. It goes on to say, after a while, the country's oil fields are now in decline, prompting industry and government officials to raise serious questions about whether the kingdom will be able to satisfy the world's thirst for oil in coming years. Now, this is a New York Times story, so it was very long, and it's written in a style in which each paragraph contradicts the previous paragraph. That's called balanced reporting. And so somewhat later on it says, Some economists are optimistic that if oil prices rise high enough, advanced recovery techniques will be applied, averting supply problems. But in the next sentence, he takes it back, says that privately some Saudi officials are less sanguine, and so on. I don't know whether in the long run of history we'll find that February 24, 2004 was the day that the worldwide Hubbard's peak was reached. We're much too close to the situation to be able to tell. It might still be 10 or 20 years away. But to those who were aware of the Hubbard's prediction, this story was a chilling story indeed. Who uses oil? Well, petrochemicals use oil. There are 6.4 billion people living on the planet today, most of them reasonably well-fed as a consequence of something called the Green Revolution that took place in the second half of the 20th century. The Green Revolution consists largely of fertilizing land using petrochemicals. I don't think we could support the present population of the world of 6.4 billion people without petrochemicals. Stationary power plants use a little bit of oil. Home heating uses oil. Those are all important, but by far the most important use of oil is in transportation, with cars, trucks, planes, ships, and trains all run on oil. The global energy consumption is shown here. In 1998, it hasn't changed all that much since then. 10 terawatts of fossil fuel, half of them in oil, the rest in coal and gas. There are various renewable sources, and all told, 13 terawatts, or 3.3 terawatts for the United States. We use one quarter of the world's energy. With 5% of the world's population, we use a quarter of the world's energy. We are profligate users of energy. 99 quads, a quad is a quadrillion British thermal units. I will not use that unit again in this talk. The economists tell us that when the oil runs out, we'll substitute something else. Let's see what else we can substitute for it. Oil refers not only to oil, like crude oil that we've been pumping up to now, but also heavy oil. That's basically what's left behind in oil fields when the light crude has been pumped out. Heavy oil gets heavier as you increase the technology and pump more out. The oil sands and tar sands are also oil. The tar sands of Alberta have been renamed the oil sands to attract investment, but it's being mined successfully today. But the operative word is mined. You have to strip mine 2 tons of ore to make 1 barrel of bitumen, a fluid that's not rich enough to distill into gasoline, so hydrogen has to be added. So some of the world's largest plants for extracting hydrogen from natural gas have been built in Alberta, and that shows what happens as you go down the list of hydrocarbons. They become more expensive both in energy and in other resources. Shale oil is unborn oil. Oil had to sink to a certain depth in the earth in order to be born, because the earth gets hotter as you go deeper because of natural radioactivity. Shale oil is oil that didn't sink deep enough to be made into oil. It can be strip mined and heated in a retort and made into a fluid that can be substituted for oil, but it's extremely expensive, and those who know say that it may be energy negative, that is to say it may take more energy to extract than you can get out of it. Natural gas is a good substitute for oil, but the Hubbert's peak for natural gas is only 10 years or so behind the Hubbert's peak for oil. And so that's only a temporary solution at best. Methane hydrate is a solid that looks like ice, but that burns if you ignite it. It consists of methane trapped in water molecules. It's created when water comes into contact with methane under very high pressure and low temperature. Nobody knows how much there is, where it is, whether it can be mined. We just know that this stuff exists. And then there's coal. We're told that there is enough coal to last for hundreds or maybe thousands of years at the present rate of consumption. The fact that that estimate varies over a factor of 10 tells you that nobody has any idea of how much coal there actually is. But the biggest source of difficulty in the statement is at the present rate. The largest deposits are in the United States, but there are very large deposits in Russia and China as well. It can be liquefied as a substitute for oil. The Germans did that during the Second World War. but it's a dirty fuel. It contains mercury, arsenic, and sulfur, and various other things. From the point of view of the greenhouse effect, it's the worst possible fuel because it's essentially all carbon. None of it is hydrogen. You have to increase the rate at which it's being produced by at least a factor of 5 to replace the oil, because we use twice as much energy from oil as we do from coal now, and the conversion process is inefficient. And even that ignores the increasing population of the world and the fact that the rest of the world would like to have a higher standard of living, that is, be more like us and that use more energy. And finally, it ignores the Hubbard's peak effect, which is just as valid for coal as it is for oil. The coal will start running out at a certain point, and that point will come most likely within this century. So what does the future hold? Well, there will be an oil crisis very soon. How soon, I can't tell you. It may be that we've already seen the oil crisis, that we're already in the midst of it. Maybe another 5 or 10 or 20 years away. 10 or 20 years is nothing on the scale of human history. Eventually, all of the fuel will run out, even if we recklessly turn to the other fossil fuels to substitute for oil. They will all run out eventually, perhaps by the end of the century. And doing that has unknown consequences for the climate of the planet. The planet may not survive. The question of whether we can have a civilization that does not depend on fossil fuel, is the answer is that the only other sources of energy are solar and nuclear. Switching to those sources of energy are a very big social and political problem. If we had visionary, intelligent leadership, they would challenge us to switch to those other sources of energy today, but we do not have that kind of visionary leadership. There are also technical aspects of that which I can say something. Solar energy includes hydroelectric energy. The enormous pressure at the bottom of a reservoir turns a turbine, which produces electricity. The water runs out and gets evaporated by the sun and pours back into the rain, into the land, and returns to the reservoir. So that looks like renewable energy. The trouble is that dams have been built wherever they can be built. We can't build more dams to replace the missing oil, and so that will not make any more contribution. Wind has started to become a real source of energy, but the wind doesn't blow steadily enough or strongly enough anywhere for it to be a reliable replacement for oil. We may inherit the wind, but we will never live on it. Biomass means you grow something and burn it. That's the way the human race lived until 200 years ago. Biomass will make some contribution, but the problem with biomass is that it's extremely inefficient. Only 1 or 2/10 of a percent of the sunlight falling on a given land area gets turned into chemical potential energy by biomass, and that's not enough. Photovoltaics are the gold standard for solar energy at the moment, 10% efficient photovoltaics. That means that in order to make 10 terawatts, the amount of fossil fuel that we burn today, you'd have to have 200,000 square kilometers of photovoltaics. All of the photovoltaics made up to present probably wouldn't cover more than 10 square kilometers, so 200,000 square kilometers is an enormous technical challenge. On the other hand, the total solar flux falling on the Earth is 20,000 times those 10 terawatts, so we are awash in solar energy. There is plenty of solar energy. We just haven't figured out how to use it yet. Nuclear is a possible source of energy. Geothermal energy, the heat in the Earth comes from nuclear energy because it comes from the decay of natural radioactive uranium and thorium. Geothermal energy is useful for space heating in various places, but it's much more difficult to use it for power. There are only a few places on Earth where a geothermal source approaches the land close enough to be reached by drilling. And in those places, it's found that the heat is exhausted faster than it can be replaced. Fission is the kind of nuclear energy that we use today. To make the 10 terawatts as a benchmark figure, the 10 terawatts that we burn in fossil fuel today, you'd need 10,000 gigawatt plants. The gigawatt is about the biggest plant you can make, and you'd need 10,000 of them. No new plants have been started in the United States in 20 years, and even if we started building plants today, it would take at least 10 years for any of them to come online, much less for 10,000 to come online. Fusion is the kind of nuclear reaction that was used in the hydrogen bomb and that's burned in the sun. A great deal of time and effort has been put into trying to conquer fusion energy on Earth, but it has not been successful. On the other hand, 1 gallon of seawater contains enough deuterium, the fuel for fusion, to replace 300 gallons of gasoline. So if we ever conquer the fusion problem, it will conquer the fuel problem forever, but we are very far from conquering the fusion problem. It has been said of both fusion and shale oil that they are the energy sources of the future and always will be. Transportation is a problem. You're not going to have nuclear or solar transportation anytime soon, but advanced batteries can be made for transportation, or you can make hydrogen to use as internal combustion fuel or as the hydrogen fuel cells, or other fuels can be made out of the hydrogen. So we understand the basic principles that would permit us to construct a civilization as complicated as the one we have now without fossil fuel, but we are not going there. So scientists are supposed to make predictions, and I make a prediction. I predict that civilization as we know it will come to an end sometime in this century when the fuel runs out. I hope my prediction is wrong, and I hope that simply making the prediction will help to make it wrong. Nevertheless, this is my prediction. There are projects in virtually every university in the country to combat this problem by now. The biggest I know of is at Stanford University, with the Global Climate and Energy Project under the directorship of my friend Lenore, is funded by Toyota, ExxonMobil, General Electric, and Schlumberger to the tune of $225 million over 10 years. That sounds like a lot of money, but it's really just a drop in the bucket compared to the size of the problem. At Caltech, we have a more modest effort called Powering the Planet, largely directed at solar energy. The people in it include applied physicists, chemists, material scientists, and so on. And Stephen Kukunin, who was the provost of Caltech, left Caltech to go to British Petroleum, BP, as the chief scientist a year ago. And so Caltech is making its contribution to the energy problem. Chief scientist at BP is one of the most important energy jobs in the world. So Caltech is making its contribution. I asked myself what contribution I could make. I'm only a physicist. I don't know anything useful the way these people do. But I asked myself what I could do to help the situation. And I figured out that what I could do is to write a book. And I've done that. And I thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Goodstein. Well, I think he's given us a lot of information to challenge us throughout the rest of the day, throughout the rest of our lives, actually. I, for one, don't want to see civilization come to an end by the end of this century, so I think we have our work cut out for us. We're going to start with our panel discussions, and the discussion for building homes today for tomorrow is going to be in the lounge room at the back. And the panel for smart growth, land use planning as a tool to reduce energy consumption will be right here in this room. So those will be getting underway momentarily. So please head to the ones that you're interested in. One announcement, there is a white Toyota Highlander that's parked out at the edge of the parking lot whose emergency flashes have been on for about the last hour. If that's yours, you might want to go turn it off.